The military force at our disposal would not have sufficed even for limited resistance. The 48 hours following the entry of the German troops into the Rhineland were, he claimed, the most tense of his life. He was speaking as usual for effect. Hans Frank recorded similar comments. If the French had really been serious, it would have become the greatest political defeat for me, he recalled Hitler declaring. But as the dictator had correctly predicted, in fact, neither the French nor the British had the will for a fight. Already by the early evening of the 7th of March, it was plain that the coup had been a complete success. With the Führer, noted Goebbels, comments from abroad, excellent. France wants to involve Befassen, the League of Nations. That's fine. So it, France, won't take action. That's the main thing. Nothing else matters. The reaction in the world was predicted. The Führer is immensely happy. The entry has gone according to plan. The Führer beams. England remains passive. France won't act alone. Italy is disappointed. And America uninterested. We have sovereignty again over our own land. The risk had, in fact, been only a moderate one. The Western democracies had lacked both the will and the unity needed to make intervention likely. But the triumph for Hitler was priceless. Not only had he outwitted the major powers, which had again shown themselves incapable of adjusting to a style of power politics that did not play by the rules of conventional diplomacy, he had scored a further victory over the conservative forces at home, in the military, and the Foreign Office. As in March 1935, the caution and timidity in the armed forces' leadership and among the career diplomats had proved misplaced. The Rhineland was the biggest reward yet for boldness. There had been no opposition from the military or Foreign Office. Remilitarization of the Rhineland was wanted by all. Objections had been no more than expressions of anxiety about timing and method. From Hitler's point of view, it was simply another case of cold feet. His contempt for the professionals in the army and Foreign Office deepened. His boundless egomania gained another massive boost. This was not diminished by alarmist warnings of imminent danger of war from Leopold von Hoesch, German ambassador in London a few days later, and Blomberg's loss of nerve. By then, Hitler could afford to sweep aside such alarmism. Condemnation of the League of Nations on the 19th of March was also an irrelevance. Locarno had been destroyed. Versailles was in tatters. The crisis was long past. Am I happy? My God, am I happy that it has gone so smoothly, Hitler remarked to Hans Frank as they sat in his special train, passing through the Ruhr, looking out on the furnaces of the steel mills lighting up the night sky on the way back to Berlin from his triumphant visit to Cologne at the end of the month. 6. The popular euphoria at the news of the reoccupation of the Rhineland far outstripped even the feelings of national celebration in 1933 or 1935 following previous triumphs. People were beside themselves with delight. The initial widespread fear that Hitler's action would bring war was rapidly dissipated. It was almost impossible not to be caught up in the infectious mood of joy. It extended far beyond firm Nazi supporters. Opposition groups were demoralized. New admiration for Hitler, support for his defiance of the West, attack on Versailles, restoration of sovereignty over German territory, and promises of peace were, sometimes grudgingly, recorded by Zopade observers. The Hamburg middle-class housewife Luise Solmitz, a conservative nationalist enthusiast, dismayed in 1935 to find her husband, a former officer of part Jewish descent, and their daughter rejected as German citizens under the Nuremberg laws, did not conceal her praise for Hitler. I was totally overwhelmed by the events of this hour, overjoyed at the entry march of our soldiers, at the greatness of Hitler and the power of his speech, the force of this man. A few years earlier, when demoralization, Zersetzung, ruled amongst us, she wrote, we would not have dared contemplate such deeds. Again and again the Führer faces the world with a fait accompli. Along with the world, the individual holds his breath. Where is Hitler heading? What will be the end, the climax of this speech? What boldness, what surprise will there be? And then it comes, blow on blow, action as stated, without fear of his own courage. That is so strengthening. That is the deep, unfathomable secret of the Führer's nature. And he is always lucky. The election campaign that followed the Rheinland spectacular, new elections had been set for the 29th of March, was no more than a triumphant procession for Hitler. Ecstatic, adoring crowds greeted him on his passage through Germany. Goebbels outdid himself in the saturation coverage of his propaganda, carried into the most outlying villages by armies of activists, trumpeting the Führer's great deeds. The dictator lets himself be bound by the people to the policy that he wanted, summed up one Zapardi agent. The election result, 98.9% for the List and therefore for the Führer, gave Hitler what he wanted. The overwhelming majority of the German people united behind him, massive popular support for his position at home and abroad. Though the official figures owed something to electoral irregularities and a good deal more to fear and intimidation, the overwhelming backing for Hitler, his enormous popularity now further bolstered by the Rheinland coup, could not be gainsaid. The problems and concerns, the grumbles and complaints of the long preceding autumn and winter had suddenly, if only fleetingly, evaporated. The Rheinland triumph left a significant mark on Hitler. The change that Dietrich, Wiedemann and others saw in him dated from around this time. From now on, he was more than ever a believer in his own infallibility. Pseudo-religious symbolism came to infuse his rhetoric. A few months later, at the Nuremberg Party Rally of Honor, messianic allusions from the New Testament would abound in his address to party functionaries. How deeply we feel once more, in this hour, the miracle that has brought us together. Once you heard the voice of a man, and it spoke to your hearts, it awakened you, and you followed that voice. Now that we meet here, we are all filled with the wonder of this gathering. Not every one of you can see me, and I do not see each one of you, but I feel you, and you feel me. It is faith in our nation that has made us little people great. You come out of the little world of your daily struggle for life, and of your struggle for Germany and for our nation, to experience this feeling for once. Now we are together. We are with him, and he is with us, and now we are Germany. 2 days later, still in messianic mode, he saw a mystical fate uniting him and the German people. That you have found me among so many millions is the miracle of our time, and that I have found you, that is Germany's fortune. A sense of his own greatness had been instilled in Hitler by his admirers since the early 1920s. He had readily embraced the aura attached to him. It had offered insatiable nourishment for his already incipient, all-consuming egomania. Since then, the internal, and above all, the foreign policy successes since 1933, accredited by growing millions to the Führer's genius, had immensely magnified the tendency. Hitler swallowed the boundless adulation. He became the foremost believer in his own Führer cult. Hubris, that overweening arrogance which courts disaster, was inevitable. The point where Nemesis takes over had been reached by 1936. Germany had been conquered. It was not enough. Expansion beckoned. World peace would soon be threatened. Everything was coming about as he alone had foreseen it, thought Hitler. He had come to regard himself as ordained by Providence. I go with the certainty of a sleepwalker along the path laid out for me by Providence, he told a huge gathering in Munich on the 14th of March. His mastery over all other power groups within the regime was by now well-nigh complete, his position unassailable, his popularity immense. Few at this point had the foresight to realize that the path laid out by Providence led into the abyss.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Hitler, 1889 to 1936, Hubris. Written by Ian Kershaw. Narrated by Graham Malcolm. Supervising producer, Mike Charsick. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Copyright 1998 by Ian Kershaw. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.